great. Okay, we'll get started. There, now we've got somebody in with Oshkosh, so get in there, Rebecca. Thanks for coming. This is our annual Supreme Court review preview, and we've got Pete Blaine and Tom Schreiner as our annual presenters for this, and we're really thrilled that they come over and do this for us. Next month, we're having our annual ethics. It's a free ethics credit. Paul Lucy and Olivia Ryer are going to be speaking. I don't have the date written down, but it's certainly on the website, and I'll send out an email and give you a little bit of warning. So come on back in December for your free ethics credit. But today, let's hear all about the Supreme Court. Thank you.
Peter? Thank you. We're going to talk about two cases the court decided. One case the court took but split on, two cases that they will hear this term, and then a Seventh Circuit case that, as of this morning, I believe it's too late to file cert about, but another case having the same issue is pending on a petition for cert, so we'll talk about that as well. The first case we're going to talk about is Husky Electronics, and the issue is whether the term actual fraud in section 523A2A encompasses forms of fraud like fraudulent conveyance schemes,
which are not actual, yeah,
that can be effected without a false representation. That was the issue as presented to the court. Just a brief review of the facts. Husky Electronics sold components to an electronic device company called Chrysalis and incurred a debt of about $164,000. Daniel Ritz was a director of Chrysalis and owned about 30% of its common stock. Over a two-year period between 2006 and 2007, he sucked out all of the assets of Chrysalis, transferring them to other entities that he owned. Husky sued, claiming that his actions constituted actual fraud under Texas law, and Ritz, in response, filed a Chapter 7 petition. Husky, in response to that, sought to have the debt declared non-dischargeable under Section 523A2A.
A bad guy. You want to rule against him, which is sort of the, right?
Underlying
fact.
Kind of underlying occurrence here. The district court found that Ritz was personally liable under Texas law, but concluded that the debt was not, quoting from the statute, obtained by actual fraud under Section 523A2A, and therefore could be discharged. The Fifth Circuit affirmed that decision, holding that Ritz's actions may have hindered Husky's ability to collect its debts, but that a necessary element of proving a non-dischargeability action was a false misrepresentation. And the case goes to the Supreme Court. Justice Sotomayor, writing for a seven-member majority, began by noting that the term actual fraud was included in 1978 when the code was first enacted, and was intended by Congress, so she holds, to be different than false pretenses or false representations. She goes on to say actual fraud denotes some kind of an actual wrong. The actual and actual fraud constitutes moral turpitude or some morally wrong action, and goes back to all the way to the statutes of Queen Elizabeth I and indicates that fraudulent conveyances under that statute were broad enough to be deemed to be actual fraud. She goes on to say, though, that fraudulent conveyances, although fraud, do not require a fraudulent misrepresentation. They're not inducement-based. The fraudulent, the false representation has never been an element, she holds, in actual fraud, and the court, in this opinion, declines to adopt it now. The court dismisses Ritz, the respondent's argument, holding that Section 523A2 really encompasses and is duplicative of 523A4, which is fraud or defalcation while acting in a fiduciary capacity or embezzlement, and 523A6, which is malicious injury to property. And the court, in a fairly lengthy passage, says there is overlap, there's natural overlap. You might have some actions that are so egregious that they're both actual fraud and fit within the other sections. But simply because there's overlap doesn't mean that they're duplicative. Ritz goes on to say, but it's duplicative of 527A2, which is a non-discharge of the entire case section, when actions are done with the intent to hinder, delay, or defraud creditors. And the court says, no, we don't agree. 527A is much broader in scope than 523. It denies the debtor the complete discharge. 727A is much broader. It denies the debtor the complete discharge, and it is narrow in scope because the action that is constitutes the gravamen for denying discharge has to be done within 1 year of the filing. 523, on the other hand, is tailored to specific debts and is much narrower. She describes 527A2 as a blunt remedy. Getting to, I think, what is the interesting part of the decision, she says that 523A2, as Ritz reads it, requires that the debt be obtained by actual fraud, and that the fraud must exist at the inception of the transaction. She dismisses that and says that the court's prior decision in Field versus Mann,
recent case,
which was decided in 1995, says that the fraudulent representation requirement and the obtained by language really relate only to that section of the statute. It wasn't intended to apply to all of the false pretenses and actual fraud in 523A2A. Finally, she goes on to say, Ritz argues that the addition of actual fraud in 1978 actually expanded the statute. And she says, no, it really doesn't. It really narrows the statute and points out that false pretenses and false misrepresentations have to be actual. And she reverses, or the court reverses and remanded. Justice Thomas writes a pretty pointed dissent, and he concentrates on the language of the statute, much a surprise to me. He says 523A2 specifically says that debt has to be obtained by actual fraud to be non-dischargeable. Actual fraud, as used in the exception, does not include fraudulent transfer schemes. And then he focuses on the obtained by language, the key, in his view, to this section. To be obtained by means that there's an element of causation. One must follow from the other. And he cites Colliers and Norton for that proposition. He says Husky can't show that Ritz made any oral or written misrepresentations to induce it to sell goods, or that he transferred the assets solely for the purpose of avoiding the obligations of Chrysalis to Husky. The majority, he says, misreads the Field versus Mann case. And when the court said reliance was a key element, it meant reliance for the entire statute, not just false misrepresentation. He then focuses on the language obtained by. Obtained by is something the court is misreading in this particular decision.
And obtained by appears at the top of the statute. It's in two. So everything we're going to talk about here, whether it's materially, false pretenses, false representation, or actual fraud, use of a statement in writing, and so on, all has to do with money, property, services, and so forth, to the extent obtained by. So that's to the extent obtained by requires causation. It's in all.
Absolutely.
That's his view.
That's his view.
He didn't win.
And he goes on to say, well, let's look at what situation there might be when there's actual fraud as opposed to false misrepresentation or false pretenses. And he said, somebody who takes a credit card and just runs up a credit card bill without any intention to pay has committed actual fraud. So that section of the statute in that instance stands alone. He says, as you might expect as he closes his opinion, that's a province of Congress. If Congress wanted this statute to apply to fraudulent conveyances, they would have said so clearly, and would have left no mistake that that it doesn't, and concludes his opinion. This is the first case of at least a couple we're going to talk about plain meaning versus what the court believes Congress intended.
And it's interesting, I said at the beginning, you know, Ritz is a bad guy, and one, including you, I think you read the facts, would want him to lose. You wouldn't want him to get away with what he did. And I think one of the things that perhaps wasn't talked about, but lying in the background of this is, you talk about people running up a credit card bill, right? Ordinary people. This is complicated. This is something that the guy structured, and that where he used the various layers of ownership and so forth in order to carry out something that an ordinary consumer debtor couldn't do. And I think it just galls at the judges not to be able to get at that and punish him. I don't know. That's my view. The other case that the court decided last term is an interesting one. And it's, you know, we ask ourselves, well, what applicability does it have to us, I guess, unless you buy tax-free municipal bonds issued by municipalities in Puerto Rico? Probably not much. But all these things have a way of coming back later on. The background of this was, the question was, does the bankruptcy code prevent Puerto Rico from enacting its own basically bankruptcy scheme to be carried out in its Commonwealth courts? The facts are, I think, things you've read about in the paper. At the time that this case arose, over $20 billion of Puerto Rico's debts held by three public issued by three public utilities companies, which were operating at a combined annual deficit of $800 million. And the numbers are staggering. A bank that belongs to the Commonwealth had previously provided funding to the utilities to fund their operating deficits, and in the course of doing that had loaned over half of its assets to the utilities. So the three utilities that provide basic requirements of life to people in Puerto Rico are in the tank in some respects. The bank that financed them, the publicly owned bank, is teetering on the brink. Puerto Rico's access to the capital markets became severely compromised, they say. Well, basically, rating agencies downgraded their bonds and they couldn't go to the market, including the bonds issued by the utilities. You know, you need cash to run a government, run any government. So, because of a problem, structural problem in the bankruptcy code that actually we'll discuss in the course of discussing the court's opinion, Puerto Rico decided it had to have its own bankruptcy act for its own municipalities as a matter of, as I say, Commonwealth law, not federal law. So it created what it called a consensual debt modification procedure. Consensual is in quotes for good reasons. It allowed utilities to the utilities to propose changes to the terms of their outstanding debt instrument, which had to be coupled with a recovery plan approved by the bank. One wonders how careful the bank would be in looking at it, given its history, to bring the utility back to financial self-sufficiency. Lots of questions here of the level of sovereignty of the Commonwealth government. Can it do things that we tend to think sovereigns can do? Now, we're used to thinking the states can't do this, right? We'll get to that in a minute, because it's part of what they gave up by coming into the Union. Puerto Rico is not a state, except when it is, right? This act, this Puerto Rican Act that their legislature adopted was based on Chapter 9 and Chapter 11 of the Bankruptcy Code. Naturally enough, it created what would be a court-supervised restructuring process in a local court to come up with the best solution for the broadest group of creditors. And shades of something else we're going to talk about in a later case that's before the Supreme Court now. How do you do something for the broadest group of creditors and of course screw some of them, which is how this all comes about, right? So a group of investment funds holding over $2 billion in bonds issued by one of the utilities brought suit against Puerto Rico and the bank to enjoin enforcement of the Recovery Act. This is a federal question suit because the basis of the claim is that the bankruptcy code prohibited Puerto Rico from doing what it had done and from implementing its own municipal bankruptcy scheme. The district court in San Juan ruled for the plaintiffs, ruled for the bondholders, that the state commonwealth statute was beyond its power, and the First Circuit affirmed really a very good opinion. I sort of had a sense of how the Supreme Court was going to come out because the First Circuit opinion was excellent, and indeed the Supreme Court follows it. Writing for, I say, a six-member majority, but that's wrong. It was a five-member majority. Justice Alito didn't participate. Justice Thomas began by indicating that the case required the court to parse three sections of the bankruptcy code. We're going to get back to plain meaning again. 109C, which is who may be a debtor under Chapter 9. 903.1, a provision in Chapter 9, that limits the ability of states to interfere with the operation of Chapter 9 once they allow one of their municipalities to go into Chapter 9. And 101.52, the definition of states, which means it says the states and the District of Columbia and Puerto Rico, except to the extent that the question is who may be a debtor under Chapter 9. So Section 109C, addressing who may be a debtor, says, and you're familiar with this because although we don't allow it in Wisconsin, some states do, California, Michigan, allow their municipalities to go into bankruptcy, into Chapter 9. Can't do it without the permission of the legislature. The legislature either has to give express permission in a particular case, or it has to pass a statute that allows for filing of a Chapter 9 petition by a municipality under certain circumstances set out in the statute, or the statute can also authorize some state officer, some statewide officer, to make that decision with respect to a particular municipality. And so the basic rule of 109C is that an entity may be a debtor if it is specifically authorized by state law to be a debtor, if it's a municipality. And municipality includes not only cities, counties, but public utilities, agencies of the state. The court describes this 109C as a gateway provision that requires states to authorize municipalities to file a case under Chapter 9. 903.1 is the preemption provision. And this actually is a pretty significant provision in terms of the relation between the exercise of national law with respect to settling the debts of municipalities. And the concern here clearly is states would do things for their municipalities, perhaps without giving too much consideration to what the owners of their debt in New York and London and China may think. And so Congress enacted this provision that says that this chapter 9, doesn't limit or impair the power of the state to control the municipalities, essentially, but, okay, broad, we're not interfering with the relationship between the states and the municipalities. But a state law, this is sub one, prescribing a method of composition of indebtedness of such municipality may not bind any creditor that doesn't consent. Okay? Basically, you can't do it because you're not going to find creditors consenting most of the time. So you can't have, Wisconsin couldn't enact such a law as Puerto Rico did. Clearly couldn't. No question of that. So the court holds that this statute bars states from enacting their own municipal bankruptcy schemes. Then it goes back to 101.52, the definition of state, added in 1984. Before that time, Puerto Rico was a state for all purposes. The term state, it says, includes the District of Columbia and Puerto Rico, except for the purpose of defining who may be a debtor under Chapter 9. So Justice Thomas said, what we're doing here is trying to figure out the effect of the definition of state on the gateway provision in 109C, and says that, you know, before 1984, everybody agrees Puerto Rico was treated as a state and could not enact a municipal bankruptcy law of its own. So the question, what is the effect of the amendment that Congress passed in saying that essentially Puerto Rico and the District of Columbia could not enable their municipalities to file Chapter 9, and the Puerto Rico says, well, it just takes us out of Chapter 9 entirely. We're not now barred by the restriction under 9031. But the funds argue that the definition in 101 keeps Puerto Rico from authorizing its municipalities to seek relief, but that Puerto Rico remains a state for other purposes other than 109C, including 9031, and so that it cannot pass a municipal bankruptcy law. So again, Justice Thomas invokes plain meaning and essentially says that the specific reference to who may be a debtor under 109C in the definitional section 10152 evidences Congress's intent to be very narrow in the extent to which Puerto Rico may not be a debtor. But because it doesn't apply to 9031, Puerto Rico is a state for purposes of preemption provisions. And the preemption provision providing that that states may not enact their own debt relief schemes binds Puerto Rico, even though Congress had removed its authority to authorize municipalities to seek relief under Chapter 9. If Congress had intended otherwise, it would have said so. I've never found that argument very persuasive, but it comes out often. And essentially says this is something for Congress to decide. And it's interesting, if you think about it, what is the difference between the District of Columbia? That's kind of easy to see, because we know from the text of the Constitution that Congress has pervasive legislative authority over the District of Columbia. It's not a state. Sometimes Congress allows the District of Columbia to be deemed a state for some purposes, diversity of citizenship, for example. Query whether that's constitutional, but it does. Puerto Rico is also not a state. Puerto Rico, in a sense, and I think this decision reinforces it, is under the pervasive control of Congress to the extent that it chooses to exercise it. It can only do what Congress allows it to do. It doesn't have that residual sovereignty to the same extent that states do. This obviously has, you know, lots of implications for Puerto Rican nationalism and feelings of being put upon. And one sees in Justice Sotomayor's dissent, joined in by Justice Ginsburg, some sense of this. She says essentially this leaves Puerto Rico unable to take care of its own problems. There is nothing now that can be done if the majority is right. We've got 3.5 million people who won't have the basic necessities of life and utilities, and there's no other remedy. But of course, there is another remedy, and it was invoked. Because once it was clear that this was a law, Congress did what it did, which was to pass a law providing the mechanism for clearing up the financial problems of Puerto Rico, and did it as a direct law, and that's what's in effect now.
The third case, of course, took up but couldn't decide because there was a 4-4 split, is the Hawkins case, which is really not a bankruptcy case, but it was touted in the popular press as being a bankruptcy case, and the first case that Congress actually could not decide because of the 4-4 split. I'm sorry, Supreme Court, a 4-4 split. You know, I note that On the SCOTUS blog, they indicate it's 244 days today since Merrick Garland was nominated to be a justice, 9 months since Justice Scalia passed away, and given the recent election and the strategy that was employed to prevent the filling of that seat, it's likely that we may see that strategy again sometime in our lifetimes. You know, to the detriment, I think, of clear jurisprudence. Well, in this case, there were two spousal guarantors, and the question was, are spousal guarantors protected as applicants under the Equal Credit Opportunity Act? Facts are pretty similar, they'll be similar to many of us. Two husbands owned LLCs, which sought some credit from a lending institution. Lending institution required the guarantees of the spouses of both owners. LLCs ran into hard times, eventually defaulted on debts, and in a preemptive move, the spouses sued the lenders, saying that the requirement that they guarantee those obligations was a violation of the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, and therefore the guarantees were void. The district court granted summary judgment to the bank, and the plaintiffs appealed. The Eighth Circuit, taking up the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, says that what the act was designed to do was to prevent discrimination against an applicant, and on the basis of marital status, among other things. And a guarantor is not an applicant. If you look at the statute, an applicant is somebody who applies for credit.
That's surprising. An applicant is somebody who applies.
Somebody who applies directly for credit. And they said an applicant doesn't include a guarantor, who is really an accommodation creditor. They're not making the application. However, the Federal Reserve Board had promulgated a regulation that said applicant includes guarantor. And so you had the conflict between the statute and the regulations, and thus the basis for the dispute.
Not the most egregious example one could find of an agency adopting a regulation that seems to run flat out contrary to the words of the statute, but often defer to them.
We often do. And that leads us to the court's analysis of this regulation in light of this statute. The court said they're controlled by the Chevron analysis. And the Chevron analysis is you first look to the statute to see if the intent and meaning is clear. If it is, that's where you stop. If it's ambiguous, then you can look to the regulations to see if the agency that's regulating this particular conduct has filled in the gaps in a logical and meaningful way. And so the Eighth Circuit applying the Chevron analysis said, we get to point number one and we stop. It's pretty clear. Applicant does not include guarantor, so we never get to the regulation. The regulation probably was enacted because the regulators wanted to stretch it to give some additional protection. Then they look at the reason for the statute. Why was the statute passed in the first place? Well, it was passed to protect women who were applying for credit but were denied because the lender was concerned about their marital status, about their
husband's debt,
about their being distracted because of bearing children, and any number of reasons. That's really what the statute was geared at, not women being required to sign a guarantee for debts of their husband. The court notes that recently the Sixth Circuit took the opposite view, and two other circuits have also come down on the other side.
In other words, upholding the agency's
regulation, saying it should be, applicants should be read to include guarantors, not just those parties who seek the credit. Nonetheless, the court, trying to sift through all of this, came down 4-4, and therefore, the decision of the Eighth Circuit stands in the Eighth Circuit, and every other circuit that has a differing view controls the law in that circuit. The Seventh Circuit, by the way, came down the same way that Hawkins did. That is, applicant does not include guarantors. Judge Posner wrote the decision and said that's stretching the statute too far. That's really, I can't get there. Applicant is applicant, guarantor is guarantor, and they're not the same. And so the law here is that guarantors aren't protected.
So what's the practical significance of having a guarantor be an applicant? What benefit do you have if you're an applicant? You can sue, right?
You can sue.
Right.
And Judge Posner said, you know, what are the damages if you sue? Not very big. You know, where do you go to a different institution and maybe you have to pay another fee for a loan application or another audit? Maybe you pay a slightly higher interest rate, so the damages aren't all that great. I think what the agency was saying, though, was if you look at the reality here, loans won't be made if spouses don't guarantee. And therefore, it's a backdoor way of twisting the arms of spouses, particularly in marital property states, where there could be a significant difference between my property and my wife's property. It's a way for lenders to get at it. So I think that's what was really driving the dispute here.
Yeah. I mean, this doesn't. The Eighth Circuit's result, which also applies in the Seventh, you know, might be thought pro-guarantor spouse, but it prevents the guarantor spouse from bringing a lawsuit for violation of the E. coli. So
it does.
Couple of cases to be decided this term. The court has granted certiorari on two cases already, and the timing is such that the briefing will be completed and they should be decided this term unless something happens. The something that's happening, that could happen, is the court finds itself equally divided, which it seems to be able to suss out even before oral argument. There are a couple of cases that I've been following in other areas of the law, really interesting cases, where cert was granted before Justice Scalia died, where the briefing, therefore, has been completed since this summer. They would normally have been set for oral argument in October or by now for sure, and they still haven't been set for oral argument. They both happen to be really tough cases. And the pundits who follow these things say, well, the court knows that it's split 4-4, and they're waiting. They're waiting to see what happens. I think they were waiting to see, you know, who President Clinton would appoint to the court and how that person would go, but it turned out the other way, and so somebody's likely to make an appointment. But we don't know how soon that's going to happen. And so to the extent that the court would like to avoid issuing 4-4 decisions in important cases and putting them off, however long this hiatus of eight justice court stays in place may determine whether these cases get decided this term or get put over. Don't know. It's just something to keep an eye on. The first case, we actually should have given you the name of the case as it appears in the Supreme Court now that it's granted cert. Of course, the petitioner is a loser below. And so this is actually the Krzyzewski case, Czyzewski, Krzyzewski versus Jevic Holding Court is the name it'll have in the U.S. Supreme Court. And here the question is, may a bankruptcy court authorize a distribution of settlement proceeds in a structured settlement that violates the priority scheme of Section 507 of the Bankruptcy Code? Case out of Delaware, where you know they're very practical, or not, went up to the bankruptcy judge in Delaware, Judge Robinson, I think, approved a structured settlement, and we'll talk about it in a minute, that certainly varied the priorities of the code, and the Third Circuit affirmed by a 2-1 vote over a strong and I think rather persuasive dissent by Judge Sirica. We'll talk about it as it comes up. So Jevic was a trucking company headquartered in New Jersey, but I assume incorporated in Delaware. You know, it was acquired by a subsidiary of Sun Capital Partners, in a deal financed by a CIT group. Great time to enter into a deal in 2006. By 2008, it was going under. And of course, it closed down, didn't notify its workers it was gonna close. So we start out with WARN Act violations in the case. And once the Chapter 11 was filed, one lawsuit that was filed by the truck drivers, a class action in the bankruptcy, in the Chapter 11, against both Jevic, the debtor, and Sun, its parent, alleging there was a violation of both state and federal WARN acts. And it prevailed against the debtor. A lot of good that will do them, but not against Sun. On a motion to dismiss, it wasn't decided until 3 years after the bankruptcy was filed, which is, you know, it's a reality and it's part of a problem that leads to a decision, that leads to a situation like this one. Also in the bankruptcy case, the Committee of Unsecured Creditors filed a fraudulent conveyance action against both Sun, the acquiring company, and CIT, the financing entity. And by March 2012, things had not gotten very far along, but a lot of money had been spent, 3 years of litigation in both of these cases. And people started talking about settlement. This is bankruptcy, right? And representatives of all the major players, including the truck drivers, sat down to try to negotiate a settlement. What was left? Well, $1.7 million in cash, subject to the lien of Sun, and the suits against CIT and Sun. And the settlement that was reached led to the suits being dismissed, releases being issued, the $1.7 million and an additional $2 million paid by the lender being deposited into an account to pay administrative claims and tax claims, and then unsecured claims on a pro rata basis.
But not the priority.
But not the priority truck drivers who had an employment priority claim, a wages priority claim under the WARN Act. Apparently it's well established that WARN Act claims are wage priority claims. So the structured part of the settlement was that the case would be dismissed, but there would be payments made in a certain area. The Third Circuit describes a structured dismissal as a disposition that winds up the bankruptcy with certain conditions attached, instead of simply dismissing the case and restoring the status quo ante. Quoting an earlier case from Massachusetts, unlike the old-fashioned one-sentence dismissal orders, this case is hereby dismissed. Structured dismissal orders often include some or all of the following additional provisions: releases, some more limited than others, protocols for reconciling and paying claims, gifting of funds to unsecured creditors, and so forth. So, not a dismissal. Why is that important? Well, it's important because the bankruptcy court's authority on dismissal is to dismiss unless for cause, a term that appears often in the code, that isn't the way it should be handled. And so this is a, I'm trying to think of a code provision, but it'll come to me. The bankruptcy court noted that structured dismissals had been approved in other courts, and indeed there are some previous Court of Appeals decisions from both the Fifth and the Second Circuit addressing this issue. From
1112.
Well, it's somewhere else. I mean, one can be dismissed. The court essentially said, the bankruptcy court said, there were insufficient assets to pursue these claims, these fraudulent transfer claims. No possibility of a confirmable plan. Under any other disposition, most of the creditors would get nothing outside the settlement. So this warranted approving the settlement. And said the court said that while plans of reorganization have to follow the priorities in the code, settlements don't. Truck drivers appealed. They sought a stay from the bankruptcy judge. They weren't granted it. They didn't ask the district court for a stay. The settlement was implemented, and checks sent out to those who were to get them under the settlement agreement. The district court affirmed the order approving the settlement, and the appeal went to the Third Circuit. Obviously, bankruptcy rule 9019 authorized fair and equitable settlements. And generally speaking, the courts look to familiar tests of what makes something fair and authorized. The truck drivers didn't contend that the normal tests weren't applied. What they said was it can't be fair and equitable if it authorizes a distribution other than according to the provisions of the code. Basically, there are only three ways to get out of a Chapter 11, confirm a plan, convert to 7, or dismiss with no strings attached. There's nothing in the code that says you can have a structured dismissal. The Third Circuit acknowledged there is no statutory authority, and Section 349 is the one I'm looking at, contemplates a dismissal will reinstate pre-petition state of affairs. And the Third Circuit says that the for cause language, unless the court for cause orders otherwise, in the section allows a dismissal that results in something other than a hard reset. So essentially, the court looks to the Fifth Circuit, which it said can't do this, and to a Second Circuit case, it said, well, that's too rigid, sometimes you can. Admitted that this was a close call. And ultimately decided that the Third Circuit would approve it because without settlement, the lawsuit would continue, would threaten to deplete the entire estate. And while it was unfortunate that the truck drivers were omitted from the settlement, indeed, from their point of view, there was no evidence that a viable alternative existed that would have better served the estate. So they affirmed the district court. Judge Sirica dissented. Finding that the settlement maximized the estate for the unsecured creditors who would not have received anything in the liquidation at the expense of the truck drivers who had a senior claim. So structured settlements, he said, violate the code. He agreed with the Second Circuit's Iridium decision about the need under extraordinary circumstances to depart from code priority, but he found this didn't apply here. It's not equitably distributed. So not surprisingly, the arguments for certiorari, which has now been granted, followed the lines of the arguments that the majority of the dissent made the Third Circuit. What I found most interesting, and I think probably had as much as anything else to do with the court granting cert and taking it up and may foreshadow how it's going to come out, is the position of the United States, as well as of 35 states and that non-state, the District of Columbia, in amicus briefs on certiorari, all of which pointed out that taxes are really important and sort of the lifeblood of government, I think, the government sites, not surprisingly. And, you know, they have a priority. And guess who's most likely to get squeezed in these circumstances, at least in their view, not in this case apparently, but in other cases, between the unsecured creditors who want something and those higher up on the pecking order, taxes. And so I think that's what's going on in this case. And my own view is this is likely to lead to a reversal.
I think the truck drivers here said, you're leaving me out in the cold.
Right.
I mean, had you just dismissed the case, I could have pursued my state law remedies. I could have gone after CIT and son, and you're leaving me with nothing.
Right.
So I think that underpins kind of the arguments that run through all of the amici.
Question would have been who financed it and so on. That's another issue.
Exactly.
So, you know, you've either got a Chapter 11 or you don't have a Chapter 11, I guess. Sort of, you want to have me do the next one? And then I'll do
sure.
The next one in order.
Yeah, go ahead.
Is Johnson versus Midland Funding, a case from the 11th Circuit, which presents for resolution an issue on which there is a clear circuit split, 11th Circuit and then everybody else. And the question really is whether a debt collector, we've seen this in this court, whether a debt collector violates the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act when it files an accurate proof of claim in the bankruptcy for a debt whose collection is barred by the statute of limitations. So is that a violation of the FDCPA? And whether the bankruptcy code itself precludes such a claim on the ground that the defendant debt collector filed a proof of claim 501A says a creditor may file proof of claim. Of course, for a debt arising beyond the statute of limitations. And just to be cut this brutally short, because we want to get done here and let talk about the next case, the 11th Circuit has said in a Crawford case a couple of years ago, that is a violation of the FDCPA, and the bankruptcy code doesn't provide a safe harbor, doesn't insulate any more than it. The fact that you may file a lawsuit doesn't mean you can file a frivolous lawsuit. Other circuits have gone the other way. The split extends to, I think, the seventh is now has gone the other way over a strong dissent from Chief Judge Wood. The eighth, the fourth, and the ninth have all gone the other way, and said that no, you can file it, and it, you can't. That cannot be a violation of the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. Interestingly, this decision from the 11th Circuit that is now subject to certiorari came down on May 24th. The losers petitioned for certiorari, the funding organization, in a debt purchaser, Midland Funding, filed its cert petition in September. The debtor filed its response 2 days later. Obviously worked together on this, saying, yeah, you should grant cert. We think the 11th Circuit got it right, but this is a mess and you gotta straighten it out. And the Supreme Court granted cert within a month at its first conference after those both came in, and it hasn't been set for argument or briefed. We'll see how it comes out. I wouldn't, particularly after the election, put a lot of money on the 11th Circuit's view, but we'll see.
The last case that we're going to talk about is a Seventh Circuit case. I checked this morning, and cert hadn't been granted. I think it had to be granted by October 28th, so we prepared this before that date. But there is another case that is pending.
It hadn't been filed? It hadn't filed for cert
okay. In this case, but there's another circuit court decision that's been appealed on the same issue, slightly modified, that is pending before the court, so we'll see what happens. And this is also a case of the 11th and the 7th versus everybody else. So the issue in this case is whether 546E, the safe harbor, insulates transactions for the sale of stock between private parties where there is a bank that is an intermediary acting only as a conduit. Does that safe harbor...
Fascinating issues. That come up often?
Comes up all the time. Very interesting issue, and the facts are set it up nicely. Owners of two private companies wanted to operate what was called a racino, a racetrack and a casino in Pennsylvania. And they were competing for a single license, so they got together and said, hey, there's only going to be one license. Let's combine forces. Company A will buy Company B in a leveraged buyout, run the sale proceeds through a bank in Pennsylvania, and we'll make a single application.
Why would they run it through the Bank of Pennsylvania?
Probably because they were looking at 546E.
Absolutely.
And that's what they did. Ultimately, the license wasn't granted. The racino went into financial difficulty and filed Chapter 11. Really interesting here, there was a liquidation trustee, FTI, acting as a liquidation trustee, looked around and said, gee, we're in the Third Circuit. I know what the law is there. I'm going to lose. Let's look for somewhere else to bring this lawsuit. So they brought the lawsuit in the Seventh Circuit in the Northern District of Illinois against Merit as a defendant. And the defendant immediately said, Judge, this is goofy. Let's transfer this back to Delaware where this case is pending. And the Seventh Circuit the District Court said no. It's not unfair for somebody to seek a forum where they might get a favorable result. So I'm not going to transfer the case, but you lose. I'm reading Section 546.
Can I change my mind?
No. I'm reading 546E, and here's what it says: settlement payments, including. Payments with respect to a securities contract, which is the purchase or sale of securities, made by or through a financial institution are subject to the safe harbor. That's what the words say. That's what this deal was, even though the buyer wasn't a commodities broker or a securities broker or the other laundry list of protected parties in the statute. And the seller wasn't any of those things either. The only party that had any connection was the middle guy, the Conduit Bank of Pennsylvania, that disbursed the money.
So not only are they horsing around with venue to get a right result, they're using a statute that Congress obviously passed to protect innocent banks from getting caught up in these lawsuits as a way of avoiding their own exposure by running it through the bank. That is, they're acting like lawyers.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So that's kind of where they started. And the district court rules against the plaintiffs and the plaintiffs' appeal. The Seventh Circuit starts out to say, what does this statute mean, right? What does by or through a financial institution mean? And he says, if I mail a letter, Judge Wood writes the opinion for the Seventh Circuit, said, if I mail a letter, is the letter being transmitted by the post office or by the sender? If I write a check, is the payment that I make by that check by me or by the bank that's paying on the check? So the words of the statute, although they seem clear, really are much more complicated. They're not really clear at all. And so the court goes on and says, the statute standing alone doesn't really help us, doesn't give us any direction. So we kind of got to look at what was intended. What makes sense here? And so the court says, the safe harbor is the flip side of the avoidance action. So let's look at the avoidance actions. Let's see what Congress intended by those to see what the safe harbor may actually mean. And so Merit says, okay, let's do that. Merit's the defendant. They say, let's do that. Let's look at the statutes. And I point out to the court that incurred by is found in section 544, 547, and 548. 546 doesn't say incurred by, it says made by. So there's obviously a distinction here. That must be something different.
That's something Congress thought about a lot.
I'm sure they thought about it for a long time. The court says, no, that's not really relevant. Section 548A2, which is the exception from avoidance for charitable contributions, also has made by. So you mean to tell me that every time somebody writes a check, it goes to a charity, that subject to avoidance? Well, that doesn't clearly make any sense. So that doesn't work. Let's look at Section 550. And the Seventh Circuit in the bonded financial case said, in order to be a transferee, in order to have the avoidance actions apply at all, you have to have dominion over the funds. And a conduit never has dominion over the funds. They're simply a pass-through entity. The economic substance of this transaction matters, says the Seventh Circuit. The statute itself, 546E, was really enacted to prevent the commodities and securities market from systemic risk. One of the large brokerage houses going down and causing a rippling effect through the market that puts the economy at risk. That's why it was passed. That isn't here. We've got a private party who's buying shares of another private party. The bank in the middle is simply a conduit. That's all they are, and we don't think that's what the statute was intended. So we're going to hold, along with our 11th Circuit sister circuit, that 546E was not intended to apply when a conduit bank was the only connection, only protected party. As I said, as of this morning, the FTI case has not been appealed. But another case, which is the last item cited, the Tribune case, is pending. A petition for cert is pending. The issue there is slightly different. There, the Second Circuit actually ruled that 546E preempts state law. In the case, the bankruptcy court lifted the stay, allowed some creditors to sue parties to an LBO. Without saying whether 546E applied or not, the court found ultimately that 546E preempts state law, and therefore the action didn't lie. So in the petition for cert, there's two questions, whether 546E preempts state law, and then the question that was presented at FTI, does it apply when there's a conduit? So we'll see whether the court takes that up and resolves that split.
Unfortunately, we're out of time, but thanks so much to Pete and Tom for their... Come on back in December for our ethics presentation. I'll send you an email, or you can check the website for the exact date. It's a Tuesday in December. Thanks again for coming.
You're welcome.